Good morning, and welcome for most of you to the ninth decade of life. This is a program that our team is going to moderate, really, and it's Claude Erbsen's idea, and unfortunately Claude couldn't be here to watch his baby being delivered. But as you know, when we reach this age, we've become consumers of medical services, for better or for worse. And as we talked about, we're consumers now of a medical system that really doesn't resemble anything that existed when we started at Amherst in 1955. The purpose of this dialogue, and it's going to be a dialogue, is really to find out how we all feel about these changes and what our impressions really are. Al Lipton, as we were planning for this, has pointed out many of the dilemmas, particularly with regard to cancer. We're surviving longer, whether you have cancer or not. By surviving longer, your chances of getting cancer increase, and you can live longer, and of course, you consume many very expensive services. If you read the literature, that people love their doctors and are dissatisfied with their medical care. Now, Steve Hirsch did a survey of his friends, and they're not dissatisfied, so maybe he will be a dissenter in some of this stuff. But anyway, our panel is really put together in order to address many of these issues. And we're going to begin with a set format. There are questions that the panel has all seen and agreed upon, and I'm going to ask my fellow panelists to comment on these, and then have you in the audience participate with your insight. Remember, we're all professionals, and our experience may not mirror your experience, so your input will be as important as our own in really managing all of this. So let me introduce us, although as the old saying goes, we should require no introduction. Al Lipton, Steve Hirsch, and myself became physicians, and all of us became academics, for better or worse. Al is in oncology, Steve in psychiatry, and believe it or not, I'm a medical geneticist. Steve also adds the perspective of having spent most of his working life in England, or at least a substantial part of it. This is somewhat out of our comfort zone, as academics usually get up there with a set of PowerPoint slides and declaim. So we're not doing that. On the other hand, Ray Hayes may be more in his natural element, so we're depending on him for rescue. Ray went on to get a PhD in anatomy, and his academic career, also in med schools, has been more focused on education of medical students, and his job is to teach the current crop of medical students how to address all of our deficiencies. So with that, we're going to get started. And please remember, this is not a formal presentation. There's no beginning and no end. And so that that means we're going to go on forever. Nobody gets lunch. Nessum duerma. Nobody sleeps either. So let me start with the first question, and I'll moderate and see if I can keep my mouth shut. For the panel, in your experience as caregivers, Al and Steve, and as a curriculum planner, Ray, how do you see the nature of the relationship between doctors and patients evolving over this recent period of time? Who wants to start? Steve.
Well, I'll start by saying I didn't agree on these questions. I think they're non-questions.
He could be my son.
I question, well, so I leave you, the audience, have to tell us, but I don't think there is such dissatisfaction and alienation. I don't think those are the issues. I think the issue is access to services, which is prevented to more than half the people in the United States because of affordability. And this disenfranchisement until you get to be older is the real issue. In the UK, it's slightly different. There's also an access issue, but it's a top-down issue because the government controls how much money is going into the health service. 2 years before the Conservatives took over, the average waiting time for an orthopedic operation was three months. It's now over 2 years. So it's again an issue of accessibility. The UK is the sixth strongest, economically the sixth strongest nation in the world. We spend 5% of our GNP on health. The US spends 20% of the GNP on health. The US is, I think, 17th or 18th, according to the World Health Organization, in terms of the quality of general quality of availability of health care. And that's looking at it across the nation, not in terms of what's available in Boston for people in the upper middle class and wealthy, but as a nation. The U.S. is, the U.K. is just ahead of the U.S. I mean, it's 1 or 2 points in the WHO rankings for different reasons, because we spend less money. And so I think these are the issues, and I think that there's a lack of will on your part and on the nation's part to do anything about it, because you're really not, you can afford to get the health care you want. I get the health care I want. I go privately. I never did while I was in the NHS. I always went to the NHS. But after I retired, I couldn't work in the National Health Service anymore, so I worked privately. And I have private insurance, so because I like to have my, when I want to see a doctor, see him within a week, not see him in 3 months or whatever. So those are the issues to me: accessibility, affordability, and how we organize health care.
Ray, do you want to take Steve's lead and follow up on this?
Yes, I'd be glad to. I thought perhaps before addressing the question, though, I ought to make a few preliminary remarks with regard to my own background. I chose not to become a clinician. Therefore, I think it's important that you understand that I've had no experience in patient care. But I have been on the front line of medical education and the preparation of the clinician to interface with the patient. My specialty area is anatomy, and as is customary in anatomical teaching, which occurs during the first year of medical school, we introduce the students to the cadaver. The cadaver, in effect, becomes the first patient that the student interacts with. And we observe very carefully how that interaction occurs. There is a slogan which is usually posted over the European Anatomical Laboratory door, which reads, "Hic locus est, ubi mors gaudet sucurere vitae." Hic locus est means this is the place. Ubi mors gaudet, where the dead are pleased, sucurere vitae, to come to the aid of the living. So this is the place where the dead come to the aid of the living. When the student enters the anatomy,
it should be enjoy, gaudia.
Gaudia.
Gaudia is enjoy.
Thank you. Enjoy. Well, okay, good. The patient becomes the first encounter of the doctor-to-be with his own mortality, and also with a responsibility to treat this first patient with care and respect. And the patient himself or herself provides the knowledge, provides the information that the clinician is seeking. So the relationship between the cadaver and the doctor-to-be is extremely important in the development of the attitudes as well as the knowledge of the physician. And I emphasize the attitude in particular because very often the attitude is not included in the preparation of the student for the profession. There is an ethic to the profession of medicine. There is a behavior expected of those who engage in the profession. And there is a caring responsibility that must be established between the patient and the physician in order for the system to work. So in addition to what Steve is saying about access, I think there is my concern that we have not really done service to the caring aspect preparing individuals to go into the field. And a lot more has to be done. I was interested, I just went to a session on curriculum here at Amherst College, led by the Dean of Academic Affairs. And I took notes on my cup because I didn't have anything to write on. But she pointed out that 37% of the undergraduate population here is in STEM curricular engagement. And that means that there's a lot of students coming through Amherst College who probably are going to head toward the healthcare professions. I wonder to what extent those individuals are getting the kind of exposure to the humanities to provide them with the basis for being a caring observer or an interactor with the patient. All of that leads to the fact that in medical education there is a stated curriculum and then there is a hidden curriculum. The stated curriculum has to do with learning the names of body parts and learning biochemistry and physiology and pathology and all of the clinical disciplines. But the hidden curriculum is the curriculum that deals with this attitudinal or behavioral aspect of development. A physician, to be effective in interaction with a patient, has to be a good listener, has to be an effective communicator, and has to be a trusted partner in the caring of the patient. We have entered a phase of medicine today where the patient has access to knowledge from other sources than the physician. The patient can get his information from the internet, can get information from other patients, can get information from family, and the physician has to be cognizant of the impact of this knowledgeable patient on the process of interaction. I would call to your attention a very interesting book that has been published recently by a cardiologist in California who might be a friend of yours.
No, but he's not an enemy either.
No. The patient will see you now. And that says it in a way because what it means is that we're no longer in that paternalistic type of relationship between doctor and patient where the doctor's orders must be followed. We're in a relationship now where the patient brings to the doctor a preliminary diagnosis, and the doctor has to work with that and hopefully come up with the appropriate solution for the patient in terms of diagnosis and treatment and counseling. So I think I'll stop at that point. And
Al, it's your chance to not quite answer my question.
Okay, so, I'm not going to answer your question, Steve, but I'm going to take a slightly different focus. As you heard from Steve, the element of cost, and I'm sure in discussions we'll be talking a lot about cost. I'd like to change the focus to how we're doing. Where are we now, and how are we doing? So this audience faces, we all face as we hit the 80s, two diseases, heart disease primarily and cancer. I'll focus in on the cancer as my field of interest. This year in the United States, there'll be 1.7 million new cancer patients. There'll be 600,000 deaths. But how are we doing? If you look back at the figures since 1991, almost every year we're doing better. So this year there'll be 27% fewer deaths than there were in 1991. So we're making progress. This year the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, will approve 11 new cancer drugs and 39 new indications for existing cancer drugs. So that's almost 50 new drugs this year alone in the treatment of patients with cancer. Now, what's the cost of this? Focusing in on the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, this year the NIH budget from the government is $39 billion. If you look at the National Cancer Institute, the NCI, this year the budget of the NCI is $6.4 billion. That's about the same amount as we're spending on the wall, or we would spend on the wall if Trump has his way in terms of doing things. So that's really a pittance in terms of the trillions of dollars that the federal government spends. The NCI budget of $6.4 billion is just now approaching what the budget was back prior to the recession a decade ago. So we're back to pre-recession levels of NCI funding. And in terms of new grants that are funded, of all the applications that come into the NCI, about 12% are funded each year, or this year. So does the NCI, is it worth it to fund the NCI for $39 billion? Well, yes, because it generates about $69 billion in income and revenue for the country. And the NCI also for the $6.4 billion is generating something like $15 or $18 billion and 400,000 new jobs related to the NCI. So what's the future? Where do we go from here? Over the next decade, the number of cancer patients is expected to increase by a third. So we're going to be left not only with $15.5 million cancer survivors that we have now, but that number is going to increase to $20 or $25 million people, and the cost of that is going to do nothing but go up. That's kind of an overview of where we are, what we're spending, what we're doing, and the progress that's been made until recently.
I would like to ask the audience a question. How many of you have had a doctor in the last 2 years tell an off-color joke or make an edgy remark? Anybody? Did you think it was appropriate or inappropriate?
Well, it was about urine flow, so I left.
Okay. but the others of you have never had a conversation with a physician that was off the main topic of the session? Okay. And the reason I ask that question is because clearly one aspect of the a doctor-patient relationship and of making the patient comfortable would be to treat them as an individual rather than as an object. So with that in mind, I'd like to ask the panel and Ray from his perspective whether or not that you think that the intimacy that you have with a patient has been altered or is any different now from what it was 25 years ago. Why don't we start with Al?
Okay. Well, the relationship is altered in the sense of there's more time pressure on the physician to see patients over a period of 10 minutes or 15 minutes as opposed to new patients over an hour. And that pressure comes in the private practice world, which I was not part of trying to maintain the office and the profitability of a private practice. In the academic setting, it's the same thing. The hospital is putting pressure. There's something called RVUs, which is units, number of patients seen per unit of time. And the RVUs are increasingly put upon the physician to see the patient over that period of time. And the other thing, I've got a good friend who is a surgeon who's now working in Portland part-time. And he's facing electronic medical records and having great difficulty with that. So not only is it more pressure to see the patients in a short period of time, but the electronics and all the other things involved in patient care take a great deal of time for physicians.
In the UK, we're discouraged from being intimate with patients.
defined it at 80 as opposed to 40.
What was your question?
About the relationship. Can you really do you relate to patients as individuals or as a medical object or an object for care?
Well, I think there's no doubt that since the period when I came into medicine as compared to now, that the particularly in England, doctors were kind of gods. They declared and they saw the patient and they declared. They didn't have a conversation. They didn't have that was the nature of things. And now, of course, patients have much more, are respected much more. We're much more wary of our patients, and we relate to them better. I think it's a thing that's improved considerably. I don't think it's something that's deteriorated. I don't think we're less, more alienated from our patients. I think it's the contrary is true, and I don't think that I'd be interested if people feel that that somehow the advance of science in medicine has had an impact on their relationship with their doctor or the doctors they see. I don't think that's the case.
Ray, what is it that you deal with in the curricular sense that you have to correct with regard to that? Do you tell them not to tell dirty jokes?
We try to emphasize the need to communicate respect to the patient and to listen carefully to what the patient says. We try to use examples through our own behavior in academic medicine as role models for the up-and-coming physician, and we try to give the student the opportunity to learn how to communicate effectively so as to build trust and confidence. That trust and confidence goes a long way toward establishing compliance on the part of the patient with what the doctor recommends, and also allows the patient to feel that he's part of the decision-making process.
As you might imagine, I ask that question because I tend to be fairly loose in my relationship with my patients. I don't necessarily use vulgarity or anything like that, but I found it very successful in establishing a relationship. But I want to phrase the next question in a somewhat facetious way. Sorry, go ahead. Does everyone hear? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to stand just to make it easier?
First introduced in the mid-'80s when I was working in a nursing home with very heavy care people, and no one had any idea what a physician's assistant was, and they are now supplanting the master's degree nurse because physician's assistants are a whole lot cheaper. So we keep on going down. The last time I checked in Syracuse, New York, at LeBoyne College, that has a large physician's assistant program, they have one class in communication. One. So the experience I have 4 years ago where I nearly died because a physician's assistant did not look at me, did not say hello, did not give me a name. All I saw was her back. And so that I got to see the doctor, but he depended on her evaluation. So I think that that's a whole other avenue now. You do get more time with these people, but they may not be trained. One class in communications is nothing.
Okay.
So that's the kind
Yes. Now, I'm going to phrase the next question kind of facetiously and toss it at Ray first. I met a woman when I first got to UCLA who was a head nurse on a psychiatry hospital, and she said something that really resonated with me, and that is I was talking about how do you train people to be sensitive and respond to patients, and she said, Steve, you can't teach people not to spit in church. And in other words, she felt that it's very hard to teach the golden rule and to teach people to behave in a manner. So, Ray, particularly starting with you, in your curricular experience, do you find that the measures you take really influence the way the individuals respond? Because most of us are going to be treated not by 80-year-olds, but by 40-year-olds.
It is difficult to teach behavior. It's very difficult to teach what I call medical ethics, that is, doing the right thing at the right time, all the time. I don't know that we have found an adequate way of assuring that that message will get across to the doctor-to-be, but as I mentioned before, the role modeling of physicians in academic medicine is what influences the behavior of the physician once he is in the field. So it's those folks in the primary care and specialty care rotations who set the tone for the physician.
People naturally behave well, and I agree entirely that it's if you have role models where people are arrogant to patients and so forth, that undermines, you know, that's where the doctors could start to go wrong. But do people, what does the audience say? I mean, I don't, is this a problem? Or do you feel that you're alienated from your doctors? Do you feel that dissatisfied with the way they deal with you? And if so, in what way?
We just moved and had to get new physicians and were told about an internist who couldn't look me in the eye. And I thought, no, I can't work with this person. He looked at his chart.
Jerry
was inclined to stay with this doctor because he said he must be very smart. And I said, but me, it's not enough. Sorry.
Seems to me that we've so far been talking about individual problems on different levels in the practice of medicine, in the time crunch that physicians face at this point. And I'm not sure I agree with Steve that seems to me that we have a tripartite medical situation, certainly in this country. And it's changed dramatically from being medically driven to insurance driven to government driven.
Yes.
And all of those three tentacles that are now overseeing the medical practice has resulted in what I perceive as difficulties, particularly for the practicing physicians at this point. My contemporaries are leaving their positions at this point because they've had enough of the government control or interference, or however you want to label it. It now has become a huge political football in this country. I don't want to sit here and listen to four doctors talk about politics because that won't help anybody. But it seems to me that the overview here is much more complicated than getting into the weeds and talking about difficulties and one at a time, because there's a whole panoply of those things that are in existence.
Robin, last remark from the floor on this question.
Treating you, you will get through, or that doctor will get back to you. There is a person-to-person telephone communication. Consequently, we have changed our principal care to Chicago. It's an hour and a half away, but it's worth the communication and the psychological comfort that comes from that.
Alan, you haven't had a chance to talk about this, but taking off on Robin's question, we're forced to document phone calls. How do you think that affects the ease with which you can answer phone conversations?
Well, I think one of the things that physicians are very concerned about is malpractice, and we haven't mentioned that before. It's a big issue in terms of, you know, who's going to sue you. I was fortunate in my medical career that I was only involved in one lawsuit, which wasn't mine. It was my partner's problem, so I got out of that. But I think that's a driving factor in the current world, is malpractice and liability.
I'd also like to pick up on a question from Robin.
Talk louder, Jerry.
Yeah. Robin gave an example of a consumer making a decision. As an institution in some way, legal services in the United States are also a sort of institution. And I wonder to what extent medicine as an institution is able to respond to stimuli from consumers. To what extent is it able to improve itself through evolution or adaptation, if you like? Most institutions are. But I'm not certain whether medicine is or not. Does feedback count?
Yeah. Al, do you want to pick
reorganize itself? Not from the top, but from spontaneous action. To what extent does spontaneous action apply in medical services? Or is it totally dominated by government and insurance companies?
Do you want to answer that? Start answering that, Alan?
Well, I think you really begin to address the cost of health care and who's paying for health care. You know, should we have the Affordable Care Act? Should it be removed? How many millions of people left without insurance? The pharmaceutical companies, their profit. The insurance companies, their profit. So it's a really economic question, which I think many in the audience may be able to address better than I. But I think I'd like to turn to Steve and ask him, you know, you've been in both systems. How do you compare the single-payer British system to the United States, more expensive system that you mentioned before?
Well, I have no experience of the American system since I was 27. I've lived in England all my life, and my medicine's always been practiced in England after leaving Johns Hopkins Medical School. I think our system works well, but is limited economically because there's a lack of resources because there's the government's not spending the money. The government turned off the taps when they got into power. They cut back on the amount of spending in health care. And it's also the amount of spending on training. It's going to take 20 years, it's reckoned, to make up the number of nurses we now have a deficit in because of the reduction in training places in nursing. So I think the system in England works very well. Everybody has a GP, and the GP refers you to hospital. You don't pay anything at any point in time. You don't pay the GP. You don't pay the hospital. You just get your care, and it's all financed centrally. And I think that's a good system.
Ray, what about your feelings?
In medical education, we're trying to prepare the doctor for the new responsibility of responding to information that's coming from the patient. I think we've reached a point where the patient is in a position to feed information or data regarding his or her own health status into a portal which the doctor can then access and respond to. You may notice that I'm wearing two wristwatches, and it's not because I need to look to the left and the right at different times.
I'm glad you're sitting next to a psychiatrist.
The instrument on my left hand is not a wristwatch alone. It's referred to as a fitness trainer. And it records my blood pressure, my heart rate. It will generate an EKG. It will read my dissolved oxygen content and do a variety of other medically relevant things. The data from here I can download onto a smartphone and then relay that data to my portal so that my doctor is able to monitor what is happening to me in real time and to respond to that by either text messaging me to say, watch out, your blood pressure is getting off track, or to provide some kind of consultation through electronic means, through email, through a telephone call, through a text message, or whatever. So that new kind of, I guess what you call telemedicine in a way, is where we are.
That's wonderful information, but can you do anything to correct anything that you find on the telephone? For instance, if he's fibrillating, can you do something besides saying, get to the hospital?
I imagine the physician could, as one of his responses to the information he has, say, you better come see me or get to the ER as quickly as possible. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I have two points. One, I'm interested in the self-absorption here. You know that we have a shortage of physicians. It's just looking at a different vein. It's a supply-demand situation. If I want to send my granddaughter to medical school, $500,000 plus in debt, why is that? We have a neighbor down the street in Swarthmore. Who's a Danish physician, completely capable. She's not allowed to practice. That's nuts. So we are way short of physicians, but somehow that's being blocked. England has a surplus of really great physicians. We won't let them in. No foreign physicians, thank you. The second thing I'd point out, and I know, unfortunately, as a patent lawyer, a lot about electronic medical systems. They're not interoperable. None of us have a single system we can make around the country. That is burning your time. You said you wouldn't get into politics, but why not? Why don't you guys just get together and say to Congress, say, listen, this ain't good. Ethic is one thing, Cerner's another thing. These people are coming to us, we don't know what the problem is. So those are two solutions you could address. Not worry about whether I'm happy with my doctors. We live there in Philadelphia and we're happy as
possible. We want you to be happy. Okay, good.
Based on being a curative process as opposed to a preventative
Well, in principle, that's correct. Last comment, Sheldon. Well, no, I was just going to go to a new topic. I have a prejudice. I think that most doctors are good. So the idea of any of this conversation is not predicated on the idea that there's something wrong with physicians as individuals. The comments about system failures are largely correct. But I want to go on to something else, because every one of these topics could be another hour issue involved, and it's the topic I want to talk about is pinball medicine. I love metaphors. Some of the patients are like the the disc in a pinball machine. You get manipulated a little bit. Those levers are your general physician, and all of the things you have to hit are the specialists. And each of them scores something, 10 points, 20 points, 30 points, but none of them have anything to do with anything else. So to the panel, do you believe that we are living in an era of pinball medicine? And can we take those different scores and somehow relate them, like with a medical record? Anyone want to start? Steve?
Nope.
No, Alan?
Well, the obvious thing is that medicine has become much more complicated, so your primary care physician can't, in my own field, can't treat lung cancer, so you're involved in a system that obviously requires referral to a great number of subspecialists, and that makes it more complicated.
Yeah.
Can the microphone be closer to their mouth?
Okay, thank you for the tip. No one else want to come in? Well, come in. I think that, Rochelle, you know. Well, but that's the primary care physician, and it's economically unaffordable on a large scale. So, yes, the concierge medicine exists because of the gaps in the current economic system that we're dealing with. I have a comment from the back. Actually, somebody who's not in their ninth decade.
Specialist.
Tom?
So I'm class of 73. I have an observation about the experience of my mother, class of 47, again, for life with heart disease. At the Brigham and Women's Hospital, she had marvelous, marvelous care. But then she had to be in Coolie Dick. And in Coolie Dick, I wouldn't say it was pinball, it was speed dating. A different doctor would come, he would look at his record, he would say something, change something, or don't change something, and be a different doctor every day. And the most important thing for me was that he simply couldn't get good information from that hospital. To me, it seemed that the doctors wanted to tell us only what the very next step would be, not looking ahead at all. And when my mother got into rehab place, I had to speak, picture taking of the records, so that I could have some idea of what really was happening to my mother. So this pinball idea for me was speed dating.
Yeah. Well, you're lucky the records actually reflected reality. That they don't always reflect that. In the back.
Yeah, I'm a cardiologist from California, but I did not write that book. And I think that the biggest change over the last 45 years that I've been practicing has been the internet. And patients come now much more educated than they ever were before with information about their disease. Disagree that things are chaotic. I think medicine has advanced so enormously, and in terms of heart disease and cancer, especially, and will continue to do that with the amazing advances in molecular biology. So I think the patients are much better off. Yes, they need some coordination of care, but the internet also permits better communication. I don't like calling patients, because it's a waste of my time and their time. Multiple calls back and forth until you finally get somebody. I give everybody my card, which has my email address, and I ask them to send me emails. It's so much faster in terms of response. The patients really appreciate it. So I think that the internet has advanced care and education.
Well, taking off on that, I use email a lot too, but I'm a terrible typist. What does the panel think about email communication with the patient? And the audience, do you feel that that's a satisfactory means of communication?
Yes.
What about the panel as caregivers?
It depends. You can be a burden because some patients, can overload you. So I think it's like everything else. It's if it's used properly, it's excellent, and if it can't be abused.
Alan or Ray?
I think I just saw my wife raise her hand.
Getting back to Sheldon's comment.
I think I saw my wife just raise her hand, and I better refer to her.
Getting back to Sheldon's.
Wait a minute.
Does she have something?
Yeah. Okay. I want to call on my neighbor, Alan. He's been very patient.
I can say, being the age group that we are in here, we can't wait for the system to change. It isn't going to change fast enough from your perspective as educators and so forth and researchers. Isn't it change fast enough to do us a lot of good? So I found that, I have to find ways. We have to find ways of getting the most out of what is out there now. And that's really what good at I am at asking the questions, she will have different perspectives. And between the two of us, we're responsible for our own medical care. But having an advocate there all the time is, I think, is improved the kind of medical care that I've been able to get over the past few years.
Excuse me, could I just add a new dimension to this?
Of course.
That's a dimension of the care of the physician. We have a son-in-law who's in his early 50s, who lives in Davis, California, who is a physician coach in the Sutter Medical System. And he is working now with physician wellness, because there's a huge burnout rate of young docs who are in the system and who can trip themselves up in a lot of ways. And so that's a dimension that I think is not entered here. And
It was one of the questions, but in case you haven't realized, we're really pretty much winging it here and letting the conversation determine what comes next. But burnout is an issue, and it probably is the flip side of the relationship issue, because physicians aren't getting the satisfaction of the interpersonal relationship from the patients. Yeah.
It seems that a number of specialists, and Al's point about treating only one type of cancer, that physicians live in the castles of their own discipline. In my own case, I had a situation a year ago where the advice of my cardiologist and the advice of my urologist were contradictory. And it took 6 months for my cardiologist to finally give a phone call to my urologist and settle it.
Well, that's ping pong medicine. That's it. We don't communicate, and we don't have a primary care physician to resolve the apparent contradiction.
I did have a primary care physician, but she played no role whatever.
Well, but that's problem, ma'am.
We have been so glad that we have, because the last 10 years or so of our medical work, he worked for the federal or for the state, and I worked for the federal government. And we were typing our own letters, we were typing up our own medical records, we were emailing patients. You don't get a secretary in this day and age. You may not.
But what if you flunk typing? Peter.
With regard to that comment and previous comments about being typing all the time, is if you're typing, you've fallen way past the curve. Voice recognition technology has wiped you out eons ago.
Well, the context that I worked in doesn't have a systematic or system-wide voice recognition. How about you, Alan? Yeah,
I agree. We had a voice recognition system.
Okay, Steve. Psychiatrist don't write
notes. I have it on my cell phone.
Okay,
that's about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't use it though. I don't like it.
And Ray, well, what is your experience in terms of the systems within which you work?
The problem, as I see it, is that change is upon us. It's occurring rapidly, and it's almost impossible to adjust or keep track or keep pace with those changes. I want to get back to a point that Sheldon made about objectification of the patient. And it came out, and it perhaps is relevant to this question about email. I think the patient-physician interaction and the relationship, if it is properly established, can allow for all of these secondary or remote relationships to occur without interfering or without objectifying the patient. It's all based upon the development of that trusting relationship between, I think, a primary care physician and the patient. I was criticized recently by my ophthalmologist that I was relating primarily to specialists and didn't use my primary care physician. But I think the primary care physician has a role to play in all of this, if given the opportunity to be the first level of interaction with the patient.
I agree. Stu?
The problem is you still have too few physicians, particularly GPs. A GP in the Philadelphia area, which is rich in physicians, has to see 25, 35 people to break even and be poorly compensated. I don't get it why the medical community doesn't open the gates to qualified people from abroad, as I said, or why my granddaughter is going to have to spend $500,000 to get through medical school. I don't get you guys. Number two, the comment made about AI, Dragon has a wonderful program if you have the right EHR system. I don't understand why the medical community is kind of twisting and flubbing around here saying, I don't understand this, I don't understand that. It's easy to understand that you need to have more physicians and you have to learn how to use a single portable medical electronic record. You wouldn't have the problem, as you mentioned up here, of seeing a patient from the East Coast or on the West Coast. I don't understand the resistance.
Well, it's not us who are determining that. It's a socio-political thing, and we're not going there. But everything you're talking about is obviously desirable. I don't think anyone would cavil with that. It's just that we can't make it happen. It's not physicians who are running the operation. Now, it's approaching 11:30, and this is Tom Ergood's witching hour. He said, you should each have the option of deciding that this is not fascinating to you. Either that or your bladders are weak, and that you may want to leave. So please feel free to get up and leave. But for the rest of us, I guess my panelists can leave too. But but since I'm the moderator here, I'll stay as long as people want to make comments and interact. We're not going to. The formal program is over. So let's have some more comments, if you will, from the audience. Yes, sir. Try to leave quietly, please.
Yeah. I want to go back to the beginning, Ray, about the cadaver. Do you have plenty of cadavers for med schools these days?
Yes. There are many who donate their bodies for medical school usage after death. So we're not dependent upon the city morgue for cadaver material. The cadavers are available. The real problem is not whether we have enough cadavers, but whether the curriculum has enough time to allow the student to do a complete and thorough dissection. Many schools are going to prosected materials and other devices that will allow the student to move through anatomy very quickly to get on to other aspects of the medical curriculum.
Yes.
State processing fee is $85. We
Well, yes.
Funerals are quite good for families, though. Yeah. And they're, you know, mourning is an issue. It's not a matter of the dead. It's a matter. Funerals are for the living.
Have any of you read the biography of Da Vinci by Isaacson? He had to get his bodies kind of illicitly and do it in secret. I didn't like the biography that much. Too much time spent on art. No, that's the dividing point of that biography. If you're really interested in the technique and sphore, whatever that is, when they're shadowing, the people love it. If you're not interested in how he was so meticulous about his painting, it gets a little bit draggy. Okay, anyone else have a comment? Well, I think, how about the panel? What is your comment? I'm the moderator. I should talk.
Well, I think doctors in England are dissatisfied, perhaps for analogous reasons to the States, but because of the control system. We used to make our decisions. We used to have committees and decide things that are happening. Now everything's being done by administrators and managers. And in psychiatry, it's particularly bad. I mean, I would never become a psychiatrist in the health service because although I think the service is good for patients, but everything is done by committee. You, if you're a psychiatrist, you have to go, you have a meeting with the social workers and the nurses and all that kind of stuff. And everybody has a say, and the doctors has still respected to some degree for their point of view, but they don't decide what's going to happen. So that's very frustrating. In the private system, which I was always against, I never had anything to do with private medicine until I retired. It's much more satisfying.
Can you get closer to the mic?
It's much more satisfying in the private system because you know, your patients come to you, and you look after, and you make decisions about the patients.
I thought you were selling government service, saying it was a good thing, but not for yourself.
I think it is a good thing from the population point of view.
But we're skirting the political aspects.
I can answer that question too.
What?
I'm not speaking. Yeah.
But I think either system has to be funded properly.
So there are a couple of things that you mentioned which I think are important, that the cost of medical school, the debt of $350,000 is driving people out of primary care and into dermatology, orthopedic surgery. Well, we have the high-powering specialties that get paid for doing something rather than seeing the patient. The other thing is physician burnout. About half the physicians are women nowadays. And I've got a daughter who's in her late 40s who's a physician with two young kids. It's a lot of pressure on people. And really, it's increasing. It's not decreasing with all the workload.
What?
I guess maybe as the voice of young physicians. So in the past week, I spent 2.5 hours on the phone with insurance to get prior authorization for medication. Do I want to get out of this?
Steve?
Yeah.
The other trend along the line, what you were saying, and I was going to mention before but forgot to, is that if you look at private practice physicians, they're decreasing by about 25% a year. People are starting to work for hospital systems because they don't need to run their own private office and run their business, and that's a major trend in all subspecialties.
Okay. With, yes. Let me. Okay. But I think it's time. It took a lot of time. I'll just give you my perspective. I personally have never had to make my living from medicine because I was paid by the university. So I had a certain amount of flexibility. And I got several things apropos of the burnout issue. One of the most interesting things about being a physician is talking to the patients and learning about life. You learn from your patients and get a lot of satisfaction from what they contribute to you about or from their narrative. And that requires time. You get nothing quickly. The narrative takes time, and people have written about this. Lewis Thomas has written popular books that describe what it was like for his father, who was a primary care physician. And I think we all know that, but all of us, life is subject to a lot of different pressures. And we all have to realize that. There are 7 or 10 things in life that call your attention: your spouse, your children, your own personal needs for privacy, getting satisfaction out of your work. And how we handle those competing needs really determines whether or not you burn out. And this is true for attorneys who have the same types of pressures. I don't know why we think only doctors face it. Jerry.
That's right.
Oh, could you stand up? Yes. I can't hear in back.
Maybe I should get an internist out here. But it's my old internist was in Washington, D.C. I looked around and asked several medical offices and doctors about it. They all said they were not accepting any new Medicare patients.
That's right.
I mean, why was that? Well, because Medicare reimbursement rates were very low in Oregon. And it just wasn't economic for them. They had to limit the number of Medicare patients so that they could survive. I said, well, what the hell? I'll pay an internist out of my own pocket. I mean, my main expense for the internist is a yearly checkup and some telephone calls and some giving traffic directions.
Until you get sick.
I've been sick, but my main expense has not been for the internist.
Yeah.
Prohibits doctors from accepting cash from someone who is Medicare eligible at the penalty of being prohibited from seeing any new Medicare patients for 2 more years or maybe longer. So the idea was that a doctor, if he were to treat someone Medicare eligible outside of the Medicare system, would have to sort of withdraw from treating Medicare patients at all for a certain period of time. Now, that's nuts to me. And it's a good example of how I'm kind of a little bit alienated from you
discussion, because it seems to me you're having an internal discussion within the medical providers community, but you're not looking at the nature of the institution, which is so heavily regulated and prevents people from entering into normal economic transactions, that of course it's not going to adjust well. Of course there are going to be these terrible cases that you described. It comes from a lack of responsiveness to the most responsive system that ever existed, and that is freedom of economic choice and the willingness to pay money for a valuable service. That's my God.
Okay. Yes, sir, in back. Loud.
A couple of quick comments. So I sort of in principle agree that the concept of the primacy of the primary care physician as being the sort of conductor of the orchestra. However, there are some, people have mentioned some of the complexities. There are some illnesses that people suffer from or conditions that make it that I think the specialist
yeah, that's snarky. I absolutely agree. Bill?
This is a possible question for 5 years from now. Several of you, Ray, and the rest have mentioned that patients are coming in, perhaps less respect, thinking the doctor's gone, and thinking maybe no one more, particularly because they look up stuff on the internet.
Anyone want to address that? Do you think that the knowledge that patients get from the internet is a hindrance or a help? Let's put it that way.
I think that any information that the patient has coming in is of value. Rather than starting from absolutely zero scratch, there may be misinterpretations, which you can address later in the discussion, but the patient who's had no information at all is a much more difficult patient, much more time-consuming.
Steve? Ray?
It's the way the conversation starts between the doctor and the patient. And the trusting element of that relationship should emanate from the response of the doctor.
I agree completely with Alan. And not only that, patients who look stuff up on the internet often teach me something. They may run across something that I didn't know. Believe it or not, specialists don't know everything about all of the diseases in their area. So I find it a plus, and we can cope with the misinformation. Okay, I think we're winding down.
Yes.
It would be ill-advised to ask you to applaud us. but feel free to do it.
Done.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well done, Steve.
You know, I don't think we got past the first question.